spectrum of social media awfulness.
Well, to my mind, I think that would be a hell of a lot better than something like Facebook or Instagram or TikTok. Absolutely, for sure. If it's just some kind of chronological listing of the things that you had already decided you wanted to see and things weren't being actively pushed towards you, that would be much better. I mean, this brings to mind an article I read a couple of months ago in the Financial Times, and it was about the viewpoints of people in Taiwan, and in particular young people in Taiwan, changing their conception of people in China, because it seems like slowly and imperceptibly TikTok usage in Taiwan has been, well, that's been going up tremendously, but slowly and imperceptibly, the algorithms from I guess it's Byte, I don't know, I can't remember the name of the company in China, but the Chinese owner of ByteDance.
Yeah.
It wasn't but in China, it's called something else. It's like Daiyu, I think, or something like that. But in any event, the parent company of TikTok in China has been slowly and imperceptibly sending over images and reels and TikTok about how the Taiwanese and the Chinese people are really quite the same, and they're very simple people, and they're these simple farmers, and the younger generation in Taiwan has really changed their viewpoint, and the charisma of the Chinese towards the Taiwanese has really been increasing, right? So they seem to be way more charismatic in China than they were just a few years ago, and that to me is really kind of fascinating, because you have this really abjectly hostile foreign power that wants to take over your country, and yet the younger generation is being convinced slowly but surely that they're not a threat. There's that to me is really, really quite scary.
Yeah, yeah. You have to find out who is behind it and expose them.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to think about with respect to these social media companies, right? You think about this, right? I joined Facebook, God, I hate to say this, in 2007 when I was a postgraduate student at Oxford. And I joined because this is where everybody was organizing social things and parties, and you would get invited to various things through Facebook. And if you weren't on Facebook, you wouldn't get invited.
And do you remember it was just for students?
It was just for students back then. You had to sign up with your university account, right? But Facebook, which then became Meta, has been slowly amassing all of this user data about not just me, but my entire generation. Now, people I went to Oxford with have become U.S. senators. A good friend of mine at Oxford was Andy Kim in New Jersey.
He got sprayed in the face the other day.
I didn't see that. Did he really?
How good a friend is he? Yeah, you know, if I got sprayed in the face, I would tell all my friends.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, I was overseas, you know, but in any event, yeah, Andy and I used to, I hope he's okay.
You should call him. You should call him. I'm sure he would welcome you, hearing from you.
He probably would,
protesting against ICE in New Jersey. That's what happens.
Well, that warms my heart because,
that he got sprayed in the face? Wow, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that he got sprayed in the face, but that he was protesting against ICE. I mean, obviously, you know, we're two peas in a pod here. Mm-hmm. But anyway, think about somebody like Andy Kim, right? He also probably joined Facebook around that time. And so Facebook has 20 years of data about a powerful U.S. politician. And if they want to utilize that information, you know, for their own benefit with respect to how could I pressure this person? What are the psychological pressure points of Andy Kim? What's stopping them from using that information as part of their lobbying efforts?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they have a massive amount of data on every single individual, way more information than any dossier created by an intelligence agency ever could. When you've been collecting
Most of what I have fed to Facebook is false. I mean, you know, from the beginning, I've been lying to it.
Well, that's you, but you're not, you know, not everybody.
It's not even me. It's not even my real name. Everything is fake. We all have the ability to do that. You know, I don't know why people don't do that more often.
Yeah, that's something you should definitely remind yourself is not necessarily like in a lot of what we're saying. We're talking about generally people that might take some of this stuff for granted or just aren't as aware of how things are structured. And, the sorts of business practices, but it's fair to say a lot of why we might be on these platforms or still participate or fared somewhat well is that we took a lot of action. We were setting our own boundaries with these companies beyond just agreeing to the terms, like how you use it.
What bothers me is that so many people use it in a way where it's become home. You know, all their pictures are there, all their memories, all their interactions. Although good luck finding something from 5 years ago, it's impossible. You know, it's people were lured into this sense of security in that environment when it really was not a friendly place at all. They don't care about you. You know, they care about you spending something that benefits them. And as Alex said, having something that they can use either for you or against you. True, you can delete your account, but then you lose everything and you don't know for sure that it's gone everywhere. We're seeing now more than ever how unhealthy these platforms are. And I think that's something that we should never let go of. And we need to reshape them so that they're communities that we are driving, not driving us. I mean, is that hopelessly naive?
No, I don't think it is. And I really do believe in the wisdom of the new generation. Right? Because to my mind, my son and his friends are not necessarily interested in any of this nonsense. And they see it as crap. And I think this is why you see so many of these social media companies, especially companies like Meta, trying to pivot over into artificial intelligence, trying to pivot to virtual reality, augmented reality, the kinds of things that will keep the kids engaged. And that's why I see these constant idiotic ads for Instagram teen accounts now, because they know better than to sign up for this crap. And I think that bodes really, really well for the future of tech in this country. But also on the other hand, you know, one thing that I think, you know, we have to call out the good and the bad, the pros and the cons, right? Companies like Meta, however, in developing their own artificial intelligence models and things like Libra and whatnot, Meta is actually, I think, a shining example of an American company that's actually innovating in an open source way when it comes to artificial intelligence. They're the only one out there providing their models as open source. They haven't done a hell of a lot lately with it, but I wish they would do more on that front. So there's something to be said for that. But on the other hand, I still think Meta is incredibly evil when it comes to the monetization of our analytics, of our user behavior, and on their social media platforms, which are pure evil.
Are you talking about Lambda?
Yeah, what was it, Lambda or
you
Libra?
Said Libra. I don't know which. I think it was called something like Lambda early on.
It began with L and ended with A, right?
I haven't followed it. But I've heard a lot about Facebook lately. Like, there's been some pretty interesting articles in the New York Times and elsewhere just about the overall financial footing, underlying stability of it. Basically their investments in that whole metaverse thing. And I don't know. I think they might not actually, they're definitely trying to make up time in that kind of pivot. But also, I mean, what happened to the lawsuits about with WhatsApp and Instagram being sort of divested from them or a part of a class or something? I mean, they built the one thing and then they bought a whole bunch of other things and then tweaked the algorithms once they had control to entrap and capture everybody. So, and a lot of this genesis of them being places where people socialize come from Twitter's early history, where a lot of people were brought in to get users to be attracted to it, to find out where those popular, you know, politicians and celebrities were. So a lot of that has just, this is the legacy of a lot of that. But I think what I'm hearing and what you're saying a lot of is that these are not stand-ins for socializing. And that was the real cruel part of the whole social media experiment in Web 2.0 days, so to speak. But there's so much here. This is an incredible discussion. And I think that, you know, that's why it's so cutthroat and just they're doing all these layoffs and stuff like that, because they're trying to compete with yet other industries they can't really buy yet.
But that's, you know, the thing of buying everything in sight and just getting bigger and bigger. That, you know, whether it's media companies or social media or you know, sports teams or whatever, that always leads to something that hurts people. And, you know, how far are we going to let that go before the entire world is just controlled by a couple of people? Rob, you're going to have the closing word because we're almost out of time.
I think one thing we've been saying about social media in all its forms, even before the big corporations got involved, you know, going back to like IRC and Usenet and stuff is, you know, it can be fun to use. It can be nice to connect with people. It can be a good distraction for a while, but don't confuse it with real life. Use it to add to your life. Don't let it be your life.
Exactly. Yes. You know, IRC was no heaven either, but it wasn't run by Microsoft. So, you know, people could shape it to be a good environment, a bad environment. That's not going to go away no matter what kind of platform you're using. But we had the ability to design it ourselves and to make it whatever it is we wanted to make it. And that's what we have to be steering back towards. Hey, we didn't mention this before, but there is no overtime tonight because we've got deadlines and we've got all kinds of other things going on. So unfortunately, there won't be one next week either because we're doing a call-in show here on WBAI that will take the whole hour from 7 to 8. So set your calendars for that. Call us up and let us know what's on your mind. And to buy the time before then, you can write to us, email, yes, oth@2600.com, oth@2600.com. And, yeah, it's been a fun discussion. And, you know, think these things through yourself and send us articles if you find anything or opinions. We would love to hear your thoughts on this. We're going to hear a lot more thoughts on it in the future for sure. This is Emmanuel for Off the Hook. We will see you next week. Good night. Over.
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and our lovely followers and patrons who give us money every month to let us know how much they like the show, to invest in it, and it's really helpful, too, so we can... I actually solved my audio problems, so that's part of the the benefit of yeah? some of the patron money. Yeah, I went back to a different system and got rid of the other one. I don't know what happened to it, but at any rate, please consider becoming a patron if you're not. Go to patreon.com/eurasianknot or to eurasianknot.org and sign up, become a patron, and chip in a few bucks. Okay, so...
How are you, Sean?
Oh, how am I? I am doing... I'm doing good. I was in Princeton last week, as you know, and I went to this conference on... This is the second conference I've went to. The first one was at NYU in October. This one was organized... pretty much by the same people, but it was in Princeton, which is a beautiful campus, by the way. I'd never been there before. And the conference is bringing together academics and people who do podcasting or audio and trying to get academics to think about audio as an additional form, but also a legitimate form of knowledge production.
That sounds actually that sounds like a fun conference. What are some of your impressions?
Well, first off, for me personally, it's incredibly inspiring because I don't have to, like, people, we're all on the same page. Like, we all see the potential that audio can do to bring academic ideas to a wider audience, to have that expression in a more creative and artistic form. And it's nice that I didn't have to, you know, you don't have to, like, try to convince reluctant academics to think about things in a different way. Everybody was on board there. And, you know, as I was telling you before we started, I think one of the things that people are thinking of is audio is not there to replace, say, the traditional academic study or monograph or article or whatever it may be. It's there to supplement. It's there to bring the knowledge to a different audience or to provide a creative outlet that reflects more academic work that maybe people who aren't specialists, you know, might not be interested in, right? So people are thinking in those directions. One of the issues that came up that I thought was really funny was academic concerns about peer review. And one of the participants, who is a very well-known podcaster named Chenjerai Kumanyika, he's great. I highly recommend everybody listen to his series on the history of the NYPD called Empire City. He stood up and he said, you know, in the production meetings for Empire City, I got more feedback and had to do more corrections and more like revisions and more discussions than I've ever had at academic peer review. He's like, let's not fetishize it now. And I think he's right. And I think that's the other thing too. Like for me personally, what we do is such a solitary endeavor. And the audio component ideally puts you in a team situation. And I find that very exciting and quite inspiring. And it also, too, like it makes me think that what you and I do here really matters. And more people are starting to do it. So we're kind of ahead of the game in some respects. So the other thing, too, and this is something I've been harping on for many years, is that there is an audience out there for what we do. There are people who would be interested to hear this information and these stories. The problem is how to present it in a way that they can access it.
Yes, storytelling is a difficult trade.
it's a very difficult trade. So, I told you before we started, I'm going to try looking into maybe holding something like the third iteration of this conference here at Pitt, maybe in the fall. So,
that'd be exciting. Yeah.
You could come.
Yeah. We made so many friends.
Yeah. So since you'll be in Michigan, you're closer. Yeah. Maybe you can, you know, if we do it in the fall or even in the winter.
I can't believe we're going to live 4 hours away from each other.
I know. Same time zone.
It's
crazy.
It's dangerous. It's dangerous.
Yeah. So those are some of my thoughts. Of course, I could talk about this for a really long time. Unless you have any more questions, we can move on to...
Yes, let's move on to the interview, which is very fitting for this conversation because it's with Alona Ledineva, whose most recent book also uses various kinds of art forms to go along with the book, specifically images, sculpture, and sound.
Yeah, the book has a soundtrack. It's an album called The System Made Me Do It, which I just love that.
Yeah, the title is just amazing.
You can find it on Spotify, but we'll do a link to all of that as well so you can listen to the music. And as you said, I want to point out the images of the sculpture that accompany each chapter were sculptures done by her. So here is a great example of a political scientist, academic, whatever, kind of branching
Here's
out.
Here's a great example of a Renaissance woman who's good at everything.
I mean, I think it's wonderful to really exercise our creativity in these new ways.
Absolutely.
You know,
if you have the means and freedom to do so, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and of course, everyone should know about her work. She's written 3 books on blot and informality in Russia.
All right, without further ado, let me introduce Alona Ledineva. Alona Ledineva is professor of politics and society at the University College London and a founder of the Global Informality Project. She is the author of the trilogy, Russia's Economy of Favors, How Russia Really Works, and Can Russia Modernize? Her new book is The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns, published by UCL Press. Here's Alona Ledineva.
Well, Alina, it's very lovely to talk to you. I've been a longtime admirer of your books. I've also read all of them up to this point. Very influential. And you have a new one titled The Russian Pendulum, Paradoxes, Practices, and Patterns. And I, of course, was struck by the very first line of the book in the preface, which reads, "The West is obsessed with Putin, but not really interested in Russia." So why did you begin this way? And what do you mean by that?
Why? It's because I live on the top of a bookshop. And every time I look at the shelf, which is about politics or Russia or something like that, all I see is Putin. And for me, it's quite frustrating because I come from Siberia and really do not consider myself ever being interested in Moscow or wanting to be there. So never being really a political person. So it is a little ironic that I'm professor of politics now. But I also have to say that this phrase doesn't belong to me. I actually cite my esteemed colleagues, Andrew Wilson and Mark Leonard and Ivan Krastev, who first made that observation about Russian studies, which are, of course, very diasporic in nature. And when people leave Russia, they develop the attitude to Russia on the basis of Western reporting, which also normally has Putin in the titles. So, and that kind of focus on Putin leaves a blind spot, in my view, which is where my work on informality comes in.
For me, the latter part of this statement is the interesting one, in the sense of we're not interested in Russia. So you clearly, like you said, with informality, are trying to paint a different picture of Russia that decenters Putin or calls us to actually put him to the side and look at other things. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I certainly aim with this book, which arguably will be my last academic text, to go beyond Putin and think about long-term agenda for non-systemic a position, forces which are being shaped as we think about the world once the Russia fully-fledged invasion into Ukraine stops, once we are through the regional wars that we experience at the moment in the Middle East and elsewhere. I really tried in this work to think in a longer term, starting with the patterns of modernization from the period of origins of the Russian state and looking in a very broad brush as to where the problem is, because it looks like we are stepping on the same rake, if you know that Russian expression. You make the same mistake about Russia, so much so that Russian experts came up with this paradox that the only predictable thing about Russia is its unpredictability. We also have Russia's insiders, such as Saltykov-Shchedrin, who said that every 5, 7, or 30 years, depending on the citation, everything changes significantly in Russia, but in 200 or 300, nothing changes. So that kind of paradoxical observation from the outside or by internal observers made me thinking, okay, not what's wrong with Russia, which is very often the pitch when we look at the Russian facades and the institutional structures in Russian politics, but rather think about what works and works so effectively that the institutions do not develop. And that has been my key question, not just in addressing Russia, but also as part of the Global Informality Project, where I look at the context with a bottom-up approach in order to sense as to how things get done and problems get solved in everyday life by people. So my approach is, let's think out of the box. You know, let's think how we could see Russia differently. Also, not making it so unique, because what I see in the Western analysis of Russia is that Russia is seen as a kind of this peculiar monster, huge, worth digging into, interesting, but truly unique. And this exceptionism, to me, is quite problematic. And now I could say this. You know, when I did How Russia Really Works, or Can Russia Modernize, or Russia's Economy of Favors, I actually didn't question that assumption. But ever since I started working on the Global Encyclopedia of Informality, and now the Global Informality Project covers 5 continents, over 100 countries, I understand much more about uniqueness and specificity. Also, in the way in which I could see unique structures all over the world, they are pretty universal human ways of behavior in conditions of shortage or pressure or stress. However, those universal practices, they become localized in a context-sensitive way. So those informality patterns, they are truly glocal.
Glocal. I haven't heard that. Well, that's a great word.
Glocality of informality. That's a new buzz word, you know.
This discussion and the discussion me and Sean had yesterday made me wonder, do you feel like ultimately this idea that Russia is always becoming, that Russia is always kind of lagging behind but trying to catch up, is this ultimately a case of Orientalism on the part of Western scholars or politicians, etc.? Would you agree or not?
Well, I didn't think about it in those terms. You know, when I talk about West-centric views of Russia, I don't mean that the analysis that we have, they are exotic in any way or orientalist in their scope or perspective. I actually teach quite a lot of political science and I use the conceptual tools. And I think it's very important way to compare Russia to the rest of the countries from political science perspective. But what my perspective adds to it is that sort of bottom-up entry point on informal praxis. Maybe I better give an example. So, for example, I came across with the six paradoxes of socialism. And that was really interesting for me because it's an anecdote of the Soviet times. I actually remember it. It goes as six paradoxes of socialism. So there is no unemployment, but nobody works. Nobody works, but productivity increases. Productivity increases, but shops are empty. Shops are empty, but fridges are full. Fridges are full, but nobody satisfied. Nobody satisfied, but everyone votes in support of the system. So give me a better definition of socialism in the Soviet period. I have not come across one. But when you look at this closely, it's quite interesting. Well, every paradox hides an informal practice that actually solves it and, you know, makes it absolutely obvious that, yes, that's a facade and a reality. So the first one, for example, there is no unemployment but nobody works, means those multiple tea breaks and social atmosphere and infinite inability to work at full capacity because, as people used to say, they pretend they pay, we pretend we work. So it's a mutual understanding, right? It's a social contract. So every paradox, and I decode them in the book, which I don't want to do here, but the, maybe just to bring up the idea of blood, which spells as bacon, lettuce, and tomato. Or bacon, lettuce, avocado, tomato. Depending
I didn't think
on,
of that before.
on, depending on your taste. But this, the BLAT practices of getting favors from people you know and exchanging informal favors or circumventing formal procedures with help of personal contacts has been really instrumental to address issues of the economy of shortage.
Yeah.
And you know the Kornay's work, Janusz Kornay's work on the economy of shortage, which pretty much has been the economic model for multiple socialisms that we had around the globe. And blood is actually complementary to that because when you have a situation of shortage, what you do, you try to circumvent it by relying on favors from friends and relations. Mm-hmm. And that actually is not universal. I mean, that's not unique,
right?
And not specific to Russia at all. And every society we've been looking at within the Global Informality Project has an analogous practice.
And it's interesting, too, because I've mentioned this on the show before, but I'll remind listeners, and maybe you know of it, too. There's a famous skit by the Soviet comedian Arkady Rykin about shortage, where he says, and the final conclusion is one of the things that shortage is, it's the glue that holds social relations together. And he says, imagine if there's no shortage, we would be an atomized, individualistic society without these relations, informal relations. And I found that incredibly insightful, even though it was a comedic act.
That's exactly, you know, a very important point because a lot of people, when I did my research in post-socialist period, had that comment that blood has gone, and some people miss it because, for many people, what they did, it was friendship. Mm-hmm. Blood was what other people did. And that kind of misrecognition game where if I do it, it's friendship. If you do it, it's blood.
Right.
Allowed those informal practices to be criticized and not really normalized, mm-hmm. but also pervasive.
Right.
So that actually is the key of that paradox. That ropes right. are empty, fridges are full.
Let's get into some of the issues that you bring up. Go ahead, Rusana.
I wanted to bring us back to the title of the book, which is structured around the idea of pendulum and the paradox. So you talked a little bit about the various paradoxes. Could you tell us more how these two terms relate? Like, what do they allow you to do for the analysis of Russia?
I think it's a very good question. And I've contemplated originally when I was thinking about this book that maybe I should talk about problems versus puzzles, paradoxes versus practices. So I was guided by the folklore and that everyday wit that you find always in Russian sources. You know, the paradoxes, for example, six paradoxes of socialism have been very crucial for me to identify which practices are hidden, but hidden from the outsiders, but absolutely familiar and everyday for insiders. And that already is a paradox because you have something like a know-how, which all insiders know, outsiders have no way of guessing. So how do you get to that reality, especially that these paradoxes capture something which is key to the transformation of society? With that, I would give you the seventh paradox, which is post-Soviet. Everyone voted in favor of the system, but it has collapsed anyway. That is, to me, is the biggest puzzle, you know, of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And how do we approach that fundamental shift, which actually generated huge debates around Russian studies? Because we started thinking about Soviet era as a 70 years of an experiment. Mm-hmm. So hoping that Russia will become normalized, you know, returning to the linear projection yeah. of, you know, the world modernization.
The Soviet period is being cast as kind of a Sonderweg.
Exactly.
Throwing the Russian people and the world off if it's progressive rise to greatness or whatever one may say.
But what happened though, the AIDS paradox came through because the system has collapsed. But it has reemerged in 30 years.
One of the interesting things about your book is the form, too, in that you include artwork by yourself. Each chapter starts with artwork and it references a song. The book actually has a soundtrack called The System Made Me Do It. Great name, by the way. And I want to have you talk about, and I should say that the music is composed by Benjamin Woodgates. I want to play a bit of one of the first songs, Particles/Waves. And this accompanies your chapter on Russian immigration. And the artwork you have is Scapegoat. So let me play like 20 seconds of the music. And then I'd like to have you talk about why you did this and describe the art and what the music means for your chapter on immigration. Thank you. Okay. So what is this all about, to put it simply?
Well, first of all, thank you for asking this question, because, of course, that is the key development of my own academic way of dealing with complexity of Russia, is to try to create shortcuts for explaining that complexity. So the idea of patterns, as I said, it came from the Global Informality Project, and I abstracted patterns of informal power or patterns of informality that I find everywhere. I've published 3 volumes of the encyclopedia, which actually stand alone. They are so fat, each volume. And what has been the easiest way for me to explain the unexplainable and to explain the complexity of informality around the globe is to distill the patterns and express them in art, which are pieces made of antique metal and tools and antique wood, something which is as ancient as the world, but they are not disappearing completely, but we need to find their place and we need to give them some attention. So the idea of the art collection on the patterns of informal power, and that was an exhibition in Paris that was called "This System Made Me Do It," was actually quite literally that. I try to express the informal power that I know is really effective in so many societies around the globe and capture those elusive patterns of its operation. So the idea of a scapegoat, the work that you mentioned, and its relevance for the analysis of immigration from Russia comes hand in hand with a biblical pattern of a scapegoat, where community places its sins collectively on a particular scapegoat who then is pushed out of the community. What I see by looking in the text on the waves of immigration from Russia is exactly that. People who are not agreeable to Sistema, people who are not consensual, people who Sistema feels to be a threat to its own reproduction, become pushed out. And of course, the main paradox of immigration is that those people who want to leave, they cannot. But those people who don't want to leave, they are pushed out of Russia. And that has been the way, actually, with every wave of immigration that I find about 9, historically speaking. And when I created that work, what I meant is exactly that periodic expulsion of people who would be a non-systemic opposition or a-Sistema people. Coming to music now, there is a fantastic review of this musical album that was actually commissioned to Benjamin Woodgates to try and capture these universal patterns and abstract them from the social context in music. And in this particular piece on particles and waves, we of course refer to the Schrödinger's cat paradox, where a particle could be a particle or a wave. And it's really, you know, like the cat could be both alive and dead, but it depends in quantum mechanics on the point of the observation. So in a way, that state of ambivalence or superposition where you could be both a wave and a particle get resolved at the point of observation. So the ambivalence as the unresolvable, unresolved state, which only gets pronounced or surfacing in a certain context-bound environment, is something that is central to the idea of the book, where I claim to be looking at, through the lens of ambivalence, on those paradoxes that we see in Russia. The music is written for two marimbas, and of course, the composer is probably the best person to explain how those particles and waves have been developing in music. But what the review says, that it's a mere four notes on the lower tone bars generating rolling waves of sound, and their constant recombination creates an illusion of harmonic development where little has actually changed. But it's against that. Tiny particles flicker from the upper register until the polarity inverts and the two forces exchange roles completely, coexisting finally in a state of mutual ambivalence. So it's actually a deceptively simple mechanism between two marimbas, but it yields something unexpectedly rich musically.
Yes, I love that approach. I love the way you put it earlier, giving readers a shorthand. And I feel like some anthropologists have tried to do it with photography, like, you know, just giving a picture, or like maybe exploring other media like film, really trying to give your readers like a feel for what's going on without it, like explaining it with the word, which is very linear. But with other media, you can kind of immerse somebody.
I liked to think to myself about the 3D type of project. So you could communicate by text, you could communicate by image, and you could communicate by sound. And all those three dimensions are captured in the book in order to reach out to the complexity that I wanted to convey to the reader.
Methodologically, I think is a fabulous solution. You already mentioned before that, you know, you see a lot of problems with analysis of Russia that focuses on Moscow, right? Is Moscow centric. And in your book, in this book and other books, you try to, you know, look at the regions, to look at like Russia beyond the MCAD. Could you tell us a bit more about the relationship as you see it between Moscow and the regions?
I should say we have two people from Siberia here.
But to ask where in Siberia you were from, because as soon as I heard Siberia, I was like, okay, I gotta know.
From Novosibirsk Academy town. And I must say my background, which is fully acknowledged in the book, is very much the Novosibirsk School of Sociology, which was Zaslavskaya, Rivkina, Khachulin, a lot of people who worked on rural areas in Altai and Novosibirsk Oblast. And I did a lot of field work when I was a student by collecting data, mainly quantitative data. And I worked very closely with mathematical methods of the analysis. And that kind of modeling, and we already then, that was in the 80s, had computers and perfocards, and we did first analysis with SPSS, or what was recreated by our own programmers as SPSS tools for data analysis. And that really has been a great school in terms of positivism and the way in which the knowledge is created, policy recommendations are made, and all that. So when I changed and I went to study in Cambridge, that really shook my foundations, because it was at the time deeply philosophical, affected by the teachings of Ludwig Wittgenstein and the linguistic turn in philosophy, and also the supervision that I got from Marilyn Strazern and Caroline Humphrey, which a lot of people really still sense in my work, because it is social anthropology. Okay, it's native anthropology, but it's really that kind of bringing people and giving voice to people which are normally unheard or forgotten. And that's why I think my attention to the regions is prominent. However, I'm not a scholar of Russian regions. And I already mentioned Natalia Zubarevich, who created this Four Russias model, which is actually much more complex than it sounds, because it's not that you attribute a region to a particular type of Russia. She shows how four Russias coexist within each region and creates a concoction of types of voting behavior, consumer demand, and patterns of, you know, normative and non-normative behavior. We've got Vladimir Gelman, who actually argued that Russia is not Russia, it's 80 plus regional regimes of power, which are all specific and could not really be seen through the same lens of analysis. And that's where we kind of have to look at the governors and the type of personalized regime, because personalism is a big thing in Russia still. However, in my effort to depersonalize political regimes and take them out of that capture of the personal leadership, I would say that, yes, personalities are very important. However, the Systema paradox, as I see it, is that every leader in Russia is actually a broker of Systema, but also its hostage. So you do have a lot of pressures which are levied upon people in power. And very often we tend to think about elites as having agency, but that's exactly the point that I very much wanted to test in my work and just really question as to how much power you have if you step out of line. And in my view, it's not a lot.
In terms of, because we often think, we were told and we read that there is a power vertical, right? That leads from the center out, radiates out. Now, I get the sense of like regional actors are constrained within the system they work. They have some kind of autonomy because of distance, things like this. But what about the center? Because the power vertical idea is that power flows down, right? And results flow up. But is the center also constrained by similar constraints that you find in the regions? How do they relate to one another?
The Systema is a complex conception, which I define as a multi-vector model of collective action outcome, which is probably too complicated, you know, and it's an academic discourse. But basically, it's the pressure that everyone feels. It's maybe the best explained by reference to Wittgenstein's idea of knowing how to continue the sequence. For example, if I tell you 2, 4, 6, 8, you would be able to continue without understanding the formula. So that's how social norms operate. You are capable of fitting in and continuing with a behavior which is socially acceptable, or testing the borderlines of the acceptability without working out as to what, how, and why. I try to see how the elites operate, for example, and how informal power could be used for informal governance, and how inner circles of leadership operates and what drives them to be what they are, and how they could almost always play double game by being part of Systema, but at the same time breaking its rules and their own norms in order to stay afloat. And that's what we see quite a lot in the 2022 period. that there is a lot of change in behavior of the elites. And needless to say, there will be many more once Putin is no longer in charge of it.
So does the Putin figure, the central, the patrimonial figure, is the power to determine to a certain extent the parameters of acceptable behavior? Because what I've seen, like Putin, one of his mains of governance, in my view, and I'm not, this is my own, I've taken it from others, that like take corruption. Corruption is both a carrot and a stick. So a carrot in sense it keeps elite consolidation, but if an elite goes outside the boundaries of acceptable theft, Putin will smack them down. And the range of acceptable corruption broadens and closes depending on the patrimonial ability to manage the margins, if that makes sense.
It does make perfect sense. The pattern has nothing to do with Putin. The pattern is Russia's officials are not punished for being corrupt. They are punished for taking more beyond the rank, as it were. So if you want to be corrupt, you have to be it in a systemic way. I've got somewhere in one of the books, I think it was How Russia Really Works, the code of a bribe taker. Or the code of kickbacks. If you want to get kickbacks, you have to consult everyone above you. You have to negotiate which percentage is lifted above, as it were. And you have to always reward those who are under you. So that's your idea of the center, right? So what you do, you have that kind of informal financial flows which back up the top and feeds the bottom. So if you are a good systema person, what you do, you actually play by the rules in a transparent way, but in the way which is consensual. And that kind of consensus, it doesn't operate at the bottom of the hierarchy. You know, you could be pretty meritocratic when you're young and just being recruited and promoted on the basis of your skills and capabilities. You know, the kind of systema considerations of whether you are the right person to benefit in a big way emerges much higher up at the hierarchy. And that's what my respondents report, that you have institutions work really well and effectively at the level of recruitment at the bottom and mid-level. The higher you go up, the more that carrot and stick works. Because if you look at the corruption mechanisms, they are not just profiting. What they also do, they ensure that you are the right person for Sistema. You actually submit your economic independence to the collective. To give you a parallel with kompromat, for example, and compromising materials or any kind of initiation rites that you find in boarding schools, in totalitarian institutions, in such as mafia organizations, youth gangs, anything, you have to submit a piece of compromat on yourself to be trusted. What it means, you could think Agatha Christie, right? A ritual murder where everyone has to stab in a circle so that no one is guilty. That's another pattern, collective responsibility or collective irresponsibility, as the case could be. So all those patterns of informality, they're really essential to the operating the regime in Russia, which actually has nothing to do with Putin, but historically they develop in this way. So my vision for the future of Russia beyond Putin is that leadership looks at those patterns and try to work out long-term solutions for those. Because that's the only thing that could create a tectonic change in Russia's development.
I actually love it because there are so many people who are deeply pessimistic. And I mean, you've written 4 books and you've studied Russia for so many years, and it's absolutely wonderful that you still have a glimpse of hope. Speaking of the 4 books, right? You wrote 4 books and 3 of them looked at informality and the Russian system. Could you tell us